The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
The fact that these guys are out almost on a daily basis in the mainstream media screaming about Trump tells you where the biggest part of the scandal is. And it becomes how far up? That's why this is so large. That's why they're fighting this so hard. That's why you're seeing all this delay in Congress. And we'll see how it plays out. Because when you start thinking about how far can this go, it could go to the biggest players. It could go to Clinton, it could go to Obama, it could go to W. Bush. Just don't know.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our returning guest, Bill King.
You know, when we look at the markets, we look at them from multiple perspectives, and we care about foreign policy, we care about domestic policy, and when we talk about domestic policy, it's both fiscal and monetary. The fact that last week we spent some time looking at sort of the change of regime, or if you will, a different kind of stewardship in terms of monetary policy, and the potential for that shifting in Europe as well as we move towards year-end, Draghi retiring, and someone coming in, Jens Weidmann probably being that person to fill those shoes. We really are talking about a change in the backdrop to the last 10 years. And as we continue to explore with Bill today, there's other factors that stretch to 40 and 50 years in terms of there being significant market dynamics, which will be different. And this is not different in 5 years or different in 10 years, but different in 2, 3, 4 months, which makes this an absolutely critical and pivotal time to be paying attention. I realize we're in the middle of summer and people are probably more concerned about the number of SPF on their sunscreen than they are the tick by tick on their stock and equity accounts. But the reality is, if you're not engaged with some of the backdrop issues here, you will be surprised when we get into September, October, and November of 2018.
Well, and getting to the backdrop issues, one thing that people seem to be concerned about right now are all these investigations that are in Washington. So I hope you get to that by the end of the conversation.
It appears that for the first time in several decades, if we have a grand strategy, it's going to run in conflict with the grand strategy, the Chinese or the Germans or just about everybody else. And so there is less of a, let's transition the word from globalization to globalism. You know, there's less of a friendly one world community when America says America first. And I think that plays into some of the market dynamics that we may see coming up here, but we've got the micro market dynamics passing, you know, 9th year of growth in the equity markets. You get the Buffett indicator, which, you know, shows equity values compared to GDP now north of 140%, only higher one at a time, 151%. I mean, devaluation metrics play a role again, and do they become front and center because some of these political things and geopolitical things remind people that risk does exist and it's not just about infinite quantities of credit in the marketplace?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And that's part of this adjustment. Some people don't get it because even we had, you know, the problems would show up here in the U.S. where it was the VIX crash, or even when you had the impeachment talk, and you get a 1 or 2 day reaction would pop right back up. Well, the VIX situation was real. That was very reminiscent of 87 with the portfolio insurance and the arbitrage that was going on, and it had perverted the market just like VIX did. And so you had some kind of purge in there, but that wasn't really the real economy. That wasn't actually the real stock market, the organic stock market in there. So what the market has understood all along here is that Trump wasn't going to be impeached, that there was nothing here, which is kind of funny. But you can see it. It had the big boom on the tax, and you know, we had it into January, and you just look back all the way from November of 2016 to, you know, the January 2018. And now it's consolidating. I mean, we see it in the big picture, the weekly picture. You can see it in the daily picture where we chop. You get play overnight. Like today, the whole play on Thursday was with the ECB meeting everything, was a 22-handle S&P rally overnight. And most of the rally occurred before the ECB communique and Draghi, and they were both more dovish than expected, which one could then assume that it leaked out. People knew that ahead of time. And what we do is, because it's expiration, you know, you should have more of a, we're just doing nothing. The only thing going up are the trading sardines here, you know, the FANG stocks. They're rallying sharply. Nothing else is rallying. And that means you got the handful of people come in, the lemmings, the day traders, you know, the guys sitting in their basements, they know to buy the app, the Googles, you know, the Facebooks, whatever. They come in, they play those things every day. But that's by and large the game. Every now and then we'll see an asset allocation. We saw those a couple times where When the 10-year got up to 3% above there, people would come in, buy 10-year, sell stocks. You could see that a couple times, and then, you know, the 10-year fell below that, and they stopped doing it. You see that in there, but by and large, we're treading water because, and you're making great points here, is the easy rally in the U.S. was done. On the tax benefit, the North Korea situation, you know, whatever here. And, you know, your questions have all alluded to this. Now we've got this trade thing, this trade situation here, that the U.S. has been on the wrong end since, well, actually, you can go back to the late 60s, but the U.S. peaked. The average worker's compensation, real earnings, especially in the blue collar, peaked around 1973. So you're going on 5 decades of these guys getting hammered, and we're at the end of something because it can't be sustained. We see it in our debt numbers. We see it culturally. We see it in a lot of things. And now we're going to try to address this situation. And you're right. It's not going to be pleasant. And that's what the stocks are trying to figure out here. Here, Europe, China's got a different situation because of their debt. Japan's got this really horrible demographic situation. Of course, it is this Germany and whatever. And again, is we're watching this thing play out. And it's not just this big boost you got from Trump. As you mentioned here, you had 10 years of this historic easy money. Nobody's gone through this transition of after 10 years of this easy money that all of a sudden the Fed has been out of that game for a good year and a half. You're right. The ECB looks like they're moving out of this within the next 6 months. China has played a game where they take money out, they put it in, they're trying to be cute so they don't have a collapse, and at the same hand, they know they have to stop the big speculation they had, so they're doing what they can in their methodology. So now all we're looking at now is really the Bank of Japan, and they are cutting back a little on their QE in here. We, you know, we'll wait and see what they do as far as their monetization of ETFs and some of this other stuff, but you know, you're absolutely asking the right questions here. Is we're transitioning out of something that is absolutely unprecedented. This 10 years, not just easy credit, but negative interest rates of massive QE, of monetizing stocks in Japan, you know, on and on and on. It's not going to be easy to make that transition. And I think what we're all watching for is, you know, what's the event? Because it is confidence. What event destroys the confidence here? And I think it is going to be Europe. It possibly could be Japan, or maybe even China, something extreme here. But where the real game for the U.S. is going to be is when that happens, how well positioned are our banks and our citizens, their liquidity, to weather that storm? Because if you can, it'll be similar to Britain. You know, when you had the Great Depression, Britain did very well in the 30s. They were positioned, they were able to come out of it better than we were because we had more access, we had more things going on here. And that's what I'm thinking with the dollar, and you're seeing this, is that people are saying when the next thing hits the fan here, and it's about to, you know, in the next few months or something's going to happen in here, the U.S. looks like they're a better position. Their banks are better. You know, we do have a big debt situation that everybody keeps pointing to, but the banks don't own that debt, whereas the reverse in Europe. The big banks there own all that bad sovereign debt here. We have corporations that are, even though they've been buying back stock like crazy, still have a lot of cash. And that's where I think you're seeing, with just on a basis here internationally, that people are starting to slowly move. And the reason this is moving slowly is that's the serious money, the big private money. We all know that the hedge funds and the traders, they're violent, and they do a lot of it without thinking. But the meticulous, well-thought-out money, if you look hard enough, you can see what's going on. You're right. The intriguing thing to me is gold. Now, gold is sitting here, and it's really caught. Because on the one hand, you got the dollar strength, you got the Fed, and that normally should be hitting gold and forcing it lower. And it has a few times. You can see when it would break down. But there's a serious bid in gold. And I think I mentioned this last time I was on. And to me, it's the big private money, the serious money, are careful buyers of gold. And we know Russia's buying it in China. Every now and then you'll see the, you know, the hedge funds will push it up when it looks like it's breaking out. Then they'll whack it down. But to me, there's a serious underlying bid in gold, because I think anybody that's reasonable that looks at this, even including the U.S. here, is that at some point, there has to be a reckoning with the debt. Now, that's why we've done this thing for 10 years with the easy money, because nobody wanted to have the debt deflation. So now, because the Fed is starting to move away, they think the U.S. banks and corporations are okay. The problem will be the government, if anything. But as long as the economy can produce enough receipts, we can pay it. Not that we're going to pay it down, but we can keep making the payments on this. The real crisis is going to become is once we have the unwind occur. You know what? It's just like, and I used this analogy before. You're teaching a child how to ride a bike. You know, you put the training wheels in. Now all of a sudden you say, and that's what we've done here with the markets, global markets and economy. So now you take the training wheels off and you're holding the bike, right? We've all, with the kids, you hold the seat and the kids pedal and you trot next to it. And then every now and then you let it go and the kid wobbles a little and you grab it back. So that's what the Fed here is, letting the bike go, but they're still holding, you know, they're close by, they're just letting go a little bit. Once you let this thing go, I think most people understand, because of the debt, this thing's going to fall. It's going to fall over or whatever. And when that happens, what do the central banks do? And I think the big private money is looking at this and they're going, yeah, we know the central banks have got to start moving away. And when they do, in whatever your period of time, you know, everybody's guessing, 6 months, a year and a half, 2 years, there's going to be a huge debt crisis. And then we're going to get the panic from the central banks. They're going to pour back in, and that's why we want to own gold. It's not for what's happening now. It's not for what's going to happen in the next 6 months, maybe even the next year and a half. It's just that the next time we have a crisis, how's this thing going to play out? So to me, that's what I'm doing, is I'm looking to stay liquid. I'm looking to keep an eye on the interest rates and stay short because the rates are moving up, and have some gold and some silver in here as an insurance in case things happen faster than you think. And wait and watch, because the real key is when the next slowdown and crisis hit, what do the central banks and governments do? That's what I think in the long term the big private money is preparing for. I think that's why you see the FANG stocks go up, because you see Buffett, these guys are buying the Apples, buying these stocks that have huge amounts of cash, because they really have become de facto convertible bonds. If the market keeps going up, you're going to get equity participation. If it goes down, they've got enormous amount of cash, you know, that should give you some floor here like a bond would. But you can see that. If you really look around, you see the big private money is positioning themselves for something's going to happen. Then we'll make the big bets once we see the governments and central banks, how they react to that. So I think that's the big picture here going forward now.
Now, going from the big picture to sort of the daily moves, we've seen something of an evolution here in the last 10 years where, frankly, algorithms and high-frequency traders were few and far between a decade ago, and today they're 80-90% of New York Stock Exchange volume. You know, if you combine the algorithm and media cycle together, you know, we started out our conversation by talking about technical analysis and what the charts are showing and everything else. Can we assume that there's been some sort of evolutionary process, not necessarily a positive evolutionary? We could think of this as almost like a cancer, I don't know, something like that, but where the markets have changed somewhat, and because of this algorithm media cycle, behavior in pricing has changed? Or is that just a temporary anomaly?
You know, this is a terrific question, because it is creating change. You can see it. You know, I think I've mentioned this before on here, because of all this computerization, the algos, these patterns are becoming more and more ingrained. You know, we used to see these, like the overnight rallies, and you see the last hour, and you see the rally into the European close, and then after Europe, that's what we had Thursday here. You have a rally, and we got hit after Draghi spoke, and then you get a rally into the close, and then right after close, you roll over again. And these things used to happen. We used to call them, decades ago, the specialist openings. You would open a stock, and then you, especially if you open strong, depending on how strong, you would look to see when it starts rolling over. It typically rolled over 15 minutes to 45 minutes after the opening. And we've been seeing this regularly, that after a really strong opening, we tend to peak 30 to 40 minutes after. And that's because this is all programmed. Before, it was just guys paying attention. Now, this is all programs. And these programs are also now with all the major institutions, the really big guys, the organic. This is programmed. So when they execute orders, they're not executing. They just put this stuff in computers and it spits this stuff out. And if it's going up, the computer knows that we're going to accelerate. If we have something to sell, we're going to accelerate it here into that, and that's what tends then to roll it over. And if they're buying something, they're going to pull away and wait for it to roll over, and vice versa. It's all programmed, and it goes on all day. So now we get these days where there's, in between, there's very long periods of nothing going on. You get the ETF guys at the end of the day. You get the VIX guys at the end of the day. You also get the institution guys play. They play heavy the first 45 minutes and the last hour to an hour and a half, because that's what the computer tells them, that's when you should play. And the rest of the way, you should just be piecing in a couple hundred every few seconds into the market. So you're right. Now, the problem has become is the more this is occurring, the more the computers are taking control, the more people are getting fired. If you look at Wall Street, the size of the trading desk and just the different departments are just dwindling. And that's why I think you're starting to see Connecticut's having tax problems in New York City, because the amount of people in financially related jobs is diminishing greatly. And this is what stocks this year had made record highs. And you're still seeing job cuts, right? You're seeing now where cities talking about cutting 10,000 due to automation. You're taking judgment out. You know, before that was the thing. You hired good traders, you had good judgment. Now you're doing more and more of you're getting computer programs in here to do this stuff, and you're taking judgment out. So things become more and more uniform. You know, it'd just be like if you program your computer to be a pitcher. You know, it tells you that, you know, 2-0, 90% of the time you throw a fastball. Well, that just gets more and more ingrained, and the batters understand that, instead of, you know, the guy that might throw you a breaking ball or something, or change up on 2-0. But that's what's becoming. Things are becoming more predictable around, you know, the times of year, the certain things. You're taking judgment away. Now, at what point do you get, though, where everything is computer talking to computer, and you'd be at, you know, this war games thing where something comes into the market, like the VIX thing, and it just destroys things because you don't have judgment. The liquidity disappears. And that's, I think, the point you're making here is, if you're just talking to machines and high-frequency guys, they all go the same way. That's what happened in 87. That's exactly what the problem. You had the portfolio insurance guys who would sell futures, and you had the index arbitrage guys who were buying futures and selling stocks. And it just got totally out of control because you took specialists. The specialists used to control the game. They lost control of the game in 1986. And I know because I was in there and I talked to these guys, and they all realized around 86, they said, we either have to get enough capital that when these program guys come in, we stop them, or we have to just get it out of the way and let them take the stocks where they want to go. And they fought them for 86, but then by 87, they got out of the way. So what happened is you had that incredible, the 27% down rally in the summer of 87. Because specialists just get out of the way. You come in here on these waves, go ahead. And then when they came to sell them, they got out of the way and you had to crash. And that's what's happening with this high frequency. And anybody with half a brain knows that people say, oh, well, we provide liquidity. No, you don't. You don't provide liquidity. You don't do anything unless you exacerbate liquidity. If you see buyers, you buy. You're not a specialist. And that's what you're programmed. If you see buyers, you buy. You see sellers, you sell. Okay, if more and more computers are doing that, then you get what you saw with the VIX. And don't forget with that VIX, that was largely derivative guys and traders. That wasn't where you get real sellers like we saw in 2008, where organic institutions and even retail people go, sell my ETF, sell whatever. When you get that real selling in there, when those high-frequency guys figure that out, then it gets to like you saw with the mini crash there, you know, that they attributed to Waddell and Reed years ago when they came in. They weren't actually selling stock. They were just trying to sell some futures to hedge their stock position. But that's what happened. The computers picked up that there's a real seller in the market, and they all tried to front run them. So you can imagine what would happen if institutions, big institutions, say, we have to start selling some stocks here. And the computers will pick that up. It might not be the first hour or whatever, but eventually it does. And then once that gets into the computers, everybody has it. You're right about what this is doing to the markets. It's a problem. There's no question. And it gives you an illusion of liquidity and complacency right now. If our thesis is right that you're going to make an adjustment, at some point enough people are going to figure that adjustment out, and then you're going to have a problem.
Some of the big themes we've talked about is new stewardship in terms of monetary policy, and that happening, if not on a global basis, at least with some of your biggest players globally. We've also talked about there being a reprioritization around national interests in sort of a diminishment of globalism with a priority to some of the fundamental things that drive real economic growth here in America. But this changes the dynamics within the financial markets. Many people have assumed that if we have a stronger economy here in the United States, that the financial markets are just going to rip and the stock markets are going to do great. And yet we're talking about some implications actually that could eviscerate the U.S. stock market in the context where everyone's doing the same thing on the basis of algorithms in that positive media feedback loop, you know, and Bloomberg anymore. Bloomberg has a computer that generates an article headline, and algorithms and other computers trading off of a computer generated headline. I mean, it's almost absurd, almost laughable. And having that move in reverse is a serious thing. I don't think people understand how frail our financial markets actually are with some of these dynamics in play.
You know, this is another great point you're bringing up. You know, we look historically, and the reason you had a stock market, the altruistic rationale is it allows for capital formation so that you can have companies, you know, mature, come to market, raise capital, And if they didn't do it, they fell apart. But the companies say, we're good. You could keep, you want to innovate, you raise more money, new plant equipment, you go to the market, blah, blah. Well, and we knew, you know, and it got crazy in the 20s because the pools and whatever, and they perverted it and it became speculation. Then you wrung that out. And then, of course, you always get the pockets with speculation in the 60s and whatever. Of course, the 80s got ridiculous. We really got into the financial engineering. And that's largely because of derivatives, computerization. You know, I don't want to get too much on that because that's a two-week discussion. But you increase the employees in financial-related services starting in the 80s, starting with mortgage-backed securities and derivatives and on and on and on. It just blew up and blew up until the computers took over, and then you just start contracting again. Now, the other thing that's happened here is in that period, you brought the LBO guys into play, and that became such a dirty word. Now they call themselves private equity. And then you had hedge funds, which used to be a horrible name on Wall Street. They were the scum. They were the leeches. And they were. They were the guys that just were front-running orders and dealing on inside information and screwing people over. And they were just nuisances. They were parasites. Then they became so big, they started commanding the markets, just like Icahn's a private equity guy, but he's by himself. He doesn't, you know, he comes in, takes a stake, and the stock goes up. You know, if KKR reports a stake in something, it goes up. You know, if Soros reports a stake in something, it goes up. Now, what has happened over 30 years is because of private equity, because it became a success, because of the big hedge funds, all of a sudden, more and more money went to these guys because they were playing a different game than the average money managers, and they did well. And the guys that did well got more and more money. The more money they got, the more situations they did. So what happened is, and I wrote this up not too long ago, these are really smart guys. And they really have better information about what's really going on in companies than what the public statements that the companies file with SEC. So by and large, as these guys and Warren Buffett were taking the best deals, you're getting the less attractive equities are what remains in the pool for the average guys. So as that got more and more risky, you have the ETFs jump in, right? Now the ETFs are in here and the indexers, and they're buying up all this stuff. So to back to your point about liquidity, the real pool of liquidity in stocks is shrinking. We know this now is when you look up and you see like the Russell 2000, there's not 2,000 stocks anymore in that. Or even the S&P, I can't forget how many are in it. It's not 500 stocks anymore. And you would think with a great boom in the equity market that you would see more and more companies issuing stock. We know they're buying stock back. So when you all of a sudden take back companies repurchasing stock, the LBO guys, the big hedge funds, the big private investors, plus the ETFs, you're shrinking this pool. And you're leaving the lower quality items for the public in here. So to get to your point, you are killing the equity market, even though it's going to record highs here. And we know that, what was it, at one point this year, two-thirds of the Dow in a game was Boeing, and I forget what, I can't remember if it was Disney or whatever it was, but you remember those days when you come in and Boeing was carrying the market on this stuff. And we're seeing this more and more as a handful of stocks producing the gains here for the indexes. So if this thing keeps playing out and you're seeing money managers go out of business because people are indexing it or going to ETFs and, you know, on and on and on. So we get a downturn in the economy. Who gets shaken out? If you're on the wrong side of this stuff, again, you're going to contract the players in the street and it's going to make the market smaller. But you're hitting a point here about the equity market. This equity market is not what it used to be. It's fragile in more ways than people understand. Because, you know, you see people like Buffett sitting a record amount of cash. You see Icahn. He's just nibbling. He sees something undervalued. He goes in there, buys it, but he's not trying to take it over. It looks like, to me, he's just trying to see something undervalued, buy it, goes up, he'll get rid of it. And you're seeing this more and more in here. So the structure of the equity market is really dangerous. Your big players in here now aren't tied to it. So you get some of these really big players in here. You know, Buffett, even Icahn, your big private equity guys, they will use the market. So if it really tumbles, they'll buy something. But they're not going to have as much exposure as ETFs, your institutions, and your retail people. And that does create a problem in here because they play a different game. Most people understand now why the housing crisis was bad is because you took mortgage securities. You bundled them together. But the wise guys started doing derivatives where they had the bundle and they would just pick out the worst parts of the bundle, whether it was the subprime, the B, the double B, whatever. And then they would keep the AAA and the double A. And everybody said, well, that was a huge problem. That's why when the subprime started going to hell, then the B, then the bubble, you know, everything got, and eventually worked your way up into the A and double A. But that's what you've done to the stock market. If you think about it, is the Buffetts, the big private equity, the big hedge fund guys, they're taking the A, the double A and the triple A. What's left? Well, what's left is being, and I haven't even written this up in our reports, But think about that. What the ETFs are doing and your indexers, they're essentially the guys that are bundling up what's left. They're bundling up the subprime to be the double B, the triple B. And they're putting it out there saying, well, this is less risky than you just picking stocks. And they're right to some degree on that. But what is in your bundle? And at some point, when this, as you mentioned, this 10-year free ride from the central banks is over, it's going to be, could be, not that it's going to be as nasty as the 2008, but it's going to have some serious ramifications for people.
Well, we could spend the next 2 hours talking about Mueller and Rosenstein and Russiagate and whatever, the FBI. And I know you've got some interesting insights in that. What's the best way for our listeners to be in tune with you on a routine basis? Because I know a good 20% of your letter, sometimes more, sometimes less, deals with stuff like that. And we haven't even scratched the surface on that today.
Well, we're getting a lot of innuendo. You get a lot of, hate to use the term, but it's true, the fake news. And now you're starting to see, you know, the IG report, the first phase, you're going to get the FISA abuse, and then that also is going to roll into the Trump investigation. This stuff is all coming out. You've got, supposedly there's grand juries, you know, in Utah. Most people believe there's been sealed indictments, and this stuff's going to play out. And this, again, is also part and parcel of the readjustment of taking this corrupted, distorted, perverted system of deep state. And you could talk about deep state on Wall Street. We're talking, you know, similar type thing where people became above the law. They thought they were the law. There was no accountability. And then you had this horrible crash in situation 08. And a lot of people argue you didn't really do anything because nobody got punished for it. The only people who got punished were the average guys. And that's true. The difference for the politicians are people will punish the politicians. People can't punish J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs. Can they? How? But they can punish politicians. And that's what's going to be fascinating is the real story here. And as you know, I had a really good source who, in July of 2016, laid out everything that is happening now. You know, the report, IG report, saying that the foreigners did get Hillary's emails. And that's what we were told. And what we were told is the reason they know that is because the NSA was watching Russia watch Hillary. I mean, it's really kind of Maxwell Smartish here, is that, you know, there's reports out that Hillary, on her first trip over to Russia, Vietnam, and China, took her BlackBerry, and the state players got her password. They didn't have to hack her. That was the big fallacy, and we told you this a long time ago. We were told they had the password. They didn't have to hack her to DNC. They were watching her in real time, and of course, the NSA was watching them in real time. And it was also reported that the NSA offered Comey the emails, and he said no, he didn't want them. And that, you know, the IG report is saying that foreigners had her emails in here. So the bigger thing to watch here is where does this lead? Because serious people, the people that were ex-Intel people, understand that what happened here is in the wake of 9/11, just like this country tends to do, is that the people at the top don't waste a good crisis. Use that to take power, and in this case it was surveillance power. You know, you saw the different movies show up, you saw these different things show up about how absolutely astounding NSA. They can monitor, I forget how many millions of phone calls a second. And they're snooping and listening and on and on. And then you got Clapper lying, that the former head lied twice to Congress. No, we're not doing that. And then Snowden and these other guys leaked out. Yes, you are. And that's why these guys leaked it. It's the scope of the surveillance. Then we got into this unmasking where one of Obama's Secretary of UN is unmasking people. Why the heck is that? Why? And then when Admiral Rogers stopped people from accessing the raw intelligence, they circumvented him. And that's where this stuff is likely to head. Now, I don't know if it's going to get there, but the big, big scandal here, and it's, again, it dwarfs Watergate, is the scope and politicization of the surveillance, that they're surveilling far more people, and they were doing it on a political basis, and the cooperation with, you know, the Five Eyes, the other Anglo countries, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and Great Britain, and how they were using each other to get circumvent the law, where you say, well, we have a law, you can't spy on Americans. Well, you know what? Hey, Brits, come here and spy on these people in the Trump campaign, and then give us the data. It's unprecedented. When you think about it, you have an ex-head of the CIA, ex-head of national intelligence, have taken gigs with the media, and they're on TV every day screaming about this. Are you kidding me? Doesn't it tell you what these guys are scared of? You don't see these guys. Most of the time, you don't even know these guys' names. And when they're done, they go deep underground. They don't want to be around. The fact that these guys are out almost on a daily basis on Twitter or in the mainstream media screaming about Trump tells you where the biggest part of the scandal is. And it becomes how far up? And, you know, people have said that. That's what happened with Mueller when he ran the FBI. After 9/11, he turned it into an intelligence organization, corrupting what the FBI is supposed to be, domestic investigative body. And that's why this all gets twisted and distorted in here with them and the CIA, the NSA, the whole thing. And it is when these things happen, just like in a war, everybody's grabbing for more power, more influence, more money, more staffing, and they're building fiefdoms. So that's why this is so large. That's why they're fighting this so hard. That's why you're seeing all this delay in Congress. And we'll see how it plays out. Because when you start thinking about how far can this go, it could go to the biggest players. It could go to Clinton, it could go to Obama, it could go to W. Bush. Just don't know. You just don't know. But if anybody really looks at it, sees what's going on, and look at people's behavior, you can see that's where they're afraid of it's going here.
As we wrap up and, you know, we look at one of the core issues here when we're talking about market-related things, what is the event? And we relate it back to the markets being held together by sentiment, by confidence. You could have something that dwarfs Watergate represent an event that destabilizes confidence in the system as it is. You can have, you know, a trade war with China represent a destabilizing event. You can have an algorithm send the wrong message and begin, you know, a meltdown, as we've talked about earlier, reminiscent of the 87 purge. There's a number of things that can crack confidence, and it can happen very quickly. With that in mind, how do you, just in a brief summary, how do you position domestic equities, commodities, oil, gold, silver, cash? If you just said, look, Dave, I'm hanging up the cleats for 2 years. I'll check back with you in 2 years. Between here and there, this is what you got to do.
Well, I think the thing you want to be here is what I've said along here is, you know, right now the Fed's paying you to wait. Before they penalized you, so you had to do something. Right now, the Fed, if you're an American, you're being paid to wait. First thing you should do, especially the average retail guy, and I'm actually, my wife and I talk about this. For all these years, we just let our money sit in the bank and been in most of it in your money market funds and whatever here. And you knew you weren't getting much interest, and you sit there and you get 0.02%, whatever you were getting. Now, all of a sudden, the banks are, with their CDs and let alone their depository rates, are nowhere near what the market rates are. So you can go out there and you can get 6 months T-bills that are over 2%. You start looking up here, you're starting to look at, you know, your 5 years, and some of these are getting, you know, 2.5% or more in here. Now all of a sudden you're getting paid. You better get out there and check. You're getting paid to watch, but make sure you're not leaving money on the table. And I got caught in this thing too, is rates were so low, you didn't really care. You didn't look around. But now you better look and see what you're being paid from banks. And I think that's another reason why the banks are under pressure here, is because there's some disintermediation going on here. You know, people that say, oh, the rates are going up, but, you know, banks could charge more for loans. Yeah, but you know what? People start taking the disintermediation, which we saw in the 70s when rates started going up. That was the big term, disintermediation of the banks. People took money out, went to money market funds and what else, where they were getting higher rates. And I think that's the first thing you got to do to protect yourself, is make sure you're paying attention to where the market is on interest rates. Position yourself to be cautious because rates are going up. Depending on your situation, you can, you know, look to extend out to 5 years. I wouldn't think I would go to 10 year yet, you know, especially when, you know, you could see your 7 years are at 2.9. They're not really, because the curve is inverting and flattening, they're not paying you right now to extend out. So you want to be shorter term until the curve starts steepening again. And you got to have some hedge in here, some type of hedge against a sudden spasm in the market, you know, whether that's gold or oil or something like that. But right now, the Fed is paying you to build liquidity. And then you need a hedge here on that in case something happens very quickly. And I think that's prudent. That's what I'm doing with my own money. I think that's where you have to be right now watching this thing. That doesn't mean if you see a situation here and you have good information that you don't go out and do something, but you better do that in a small, measured, careful way. Just like Buffett is doing, just like I can, just like the smart guys are doing here. But they're waiting, and it's coming their way, and that's what they know. The more cash they have, they're getting paid more for the cash, and they also understand that means eventually someone's going to have to disgorge assets. And that's what they're waiting for, is when people have to disgorge assets at beneficial prices. And that's how people have to be thinking right now.
So liquidity and a hedge against that liquidity, and be patient.
Yep, insurance, right, just insurance. And then be patient for when there's some kind of, you know, adjustment, purge, whatever. And then you have to be careful and watch and see how that plays out here. Because the one thing that's sitting out here that troubles me the most is over the last 10 years, we've gotten the mini crash, the flash crash. We had the VIX crash. We had 2011 and 12 was Europe or 10, or whatever it was. We had the summers where Europe's, where we had the little things, and everything just keeps bouncing back, goes to new highs. So you've got people that are 35 or under that are in the business are used to just buying, always thinking you go to new highs. You're going to get a situation there, and this is the one where you got to, if you're bullish here, and that's fine. Technicals are such that you can be in stocks here, but you got to be careful. Is that when we get a good downward reaction and then we get a bounce, if you take out that secondary reaction, look out. And that's what we've been all along. We had that VIX low there in February. If that thing ever got taken out, it was going to be trouble. I mean, that's what really happened in 87. You know, you peaked there late August, and then you went up, and then you start rolling over, then you went up again, and then when you took out the September low, it crashed. You could be getting short of 20, it's the same way. There's like a level there, the reaction low, and that's some of where the Dow theory comes from, is that when you get that first significant decline after a high, and you go up, and you rally, and you don't make a new high, and then when you take that reaction low out, it gets ugly. And that's what I would look for here if you want to own stocks here. You better know, you better have a plan that when you're going to get out. Because when it becomes apparent to most people you should be out, you're going to have a very difficult time getting out.
Well, as we've talked about earlier, there's an impression or an illusion of liquidity in the marketplace.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, Bill, thanks for joining us on the commentary. Sure. You always bring fresh insight and historical perspective, and great to have you back. Hope you enjoy your summer and look forward to visiting again soon.
Oh, anytime. Thank you guys very much.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Bill King. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. And you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.